November. Lowell, Trans-Canada Highway, New Brunswick.
The wolf stories. I'm stuck right now. I don't know where to take them next. People keep asking me if I'm a writer or a journalist when I try to record them. I don't think I am, though. Either of those things. If I was, I wouldn't keep getting stuck on the wolf stories. When I record people, it's just about sound. Because I'm looking for sound. The stories are just distractions. Everyone's asleep on the bus right now. Some old lady snoring in the seat ahead of me. That's the sound around me. Someone's occasional coughing. The sound of the bus tires rolling on the highway. We'll be in Montreal first thing in the morning. Jane's in Montreal. Feelings and people. But, whatever that was happening in Perth Andover, the riot, or whatever, upriver. I mean, if I had been from there, or knew the area, it would have been less creepy. But because I was a stranger there, like, not familiar with the area and all the stories going around, that was what really made me anxious to get out of there. It was pretty and everything, and the people were really nice, but tonight we left all of it behind. Bus drove right past it. The reserve, it's on the other side of the river from the highway that we're on, over on the Perth side, I guess. Whole bunch of bonfires over there, flickering. Bunch of bonfires and flashing. Like police cars, those kinds of flashing lights. We just drove right past it. It is Halloween night, and I'm heading into Quebec. Keith paid me more than he had to. More than I actually worked. I got decent money in my pockets again, finally. It's gonna be pretty cool to see Jane again. I should probably get some sleep now, but I don't feel sleepy. I get used to working the graveyard shift. The occasional cough. The sound of tires rolling on the highway. Good night, tape recorder. Get some rest, tape recorder. Feelings and people. Good night.
Wanda, 24. Rivière du Loup, Quebec.
I'm traveling to Ottawa to go visit my sister. She keeps sending me and my family all these emails about weird stuff happening in Ottawa, so my parents asked me to go visit her and make sure she's still taking her medication, and to bring her back to New Brunswick if she's gone crazy for real. But she's a real free spirit. But I'm talking to Lowell now because he asked me if he could record me, and I said yes, because I have a story I'd like to pitch to him and get his feedback on, because he tells me he's been writing stories too. Once upon a time, there was this girl named Melinda, and she was a mermaid, and she lived in the ocean and rode on dolphins and fell in love with the Prince of Atlantis, Prince Finley. Unfortunately for Melinda, however, Prince Finley was royalty, the prince of a kingdom, and she was just a regular mermaid with no royal blood and didn't even have any seashells to her name, hardly at all. Seashells are the currency they use in Atlantis. And there was this royal ball that they held every year in Atlantis that the king put on that all of the rich mermaids got invited to so they could dance with the king's son, the prince. And if the prince decided that he wanted to marry any of the girls at the dance, he could. But year after year, they held the dance, and year after year, Prince Finley never found a mermaid that he likes. And Melinda never got to go to these mermaid dances because she never had enough seashells to buy an outfit. But then, one day, her friend, Sammy the Seahorse, came up with the idea to rob the First Atlantis National Bank. And he asked Melinda to rob the place with him. And Melinda was poor because she didn't have enough seashells and was barely scraping by and had to eat seaweed her whole life and didn't even have any pearls. So Melinda decides to help Sammy the seahorse rob the bank. And they get Carl the crab to help them because Carl owns a trident store and they need tridents to hold up the other mermaids at the bank. So they walk into the bank with the tridents, and this is how the story starts. I'm trying to develop it into a screenplay. I have a friend at school who's helping me with it. His name's Brent Bell. He's a writer, like an actual writer. And I've always loved mermaids. And he wants to get into film. And I have a lot of ideas. And film is really big now. And if I don't try and make it into a full-length film, we might try to make it into a TV show, because I'm pretty sure the story is pretty original. I haven't seen anything like it. See, because Melinda wants to go to this dance so bad that she becomes a bank robber with her friends. But then things get complicated because there's this humpback whale that's like the best detective in Atlantis. And he's really old, but really smart, like Columbo, Wally the Whale. And he starts tracking them down after they rob the bank because Carl the Crab dropped his wallet in the bank while they were robbing it. But Melinda's really likable, too, so Wally starts to feel really conflicted about trying to arrest her because she never uses all the seashells for herself. Like, she only uses enough seashells to buy a dress and some nice shoes and some pearls and a dolphin carrot so she can go to the royal dance, so she can dance with the prince. But the rest of the seashells she gives to charity. So she's kind of like a Robin Hood in a way. And Wally the humpback whale kind of respects her. You know, because his parents were poor growing up, and being poor is really tough on whales because they have to eat so much to maintain their body weight and stay healthy. I know the story is original. Like, I know no one's written anything like that before, because it's like a mermaid version of Breaking Bad. Because the more banks she robs, the more trouble she gets into. And then Sammy the seahorse gets shot during this big heist, and she gets really sad, and they have to go to his funeral to pay respects without getting caught by the police. And in Montreal, they have a mermaid school. Did you know that? It's a school where you can put on a tail, and they'll teach you to swim like a mermaid. So, like, all the resources are there to do the show. Like, you can just teach actors to swim like mermaids, and you wouldn't even have to use green screen or any CGI. And the story is, like, really universal, because most countries in the world are next to the ocean, so they all know about Atlantis and all that. The hardest part is going to be getting a big-name actor to play the King of Atlantis, but whoever it is, it has to be epic, like Gary Oldman or something. But once we get someone on board, the CBC would be idiots not to pick up the show or make it into a movie. And I know I'm talking about it a lot, but I've been putting a lot of time into it, and that's why. And Brent Bell, he's been helping me write it, and we already have character biographies written up and everything, and synopsises and everything. And I think there's some people in Ottawa who know about film, too, and theater, so when I get there... I mean, part of the trip is I'm going to my friend's wedding, and part of it is I'm going to be networking and trying to meet people from the industry so I can sell it to them. I mean, it's like, I'm from Rosse, right? New Brunswick. So it's a pretty big deal if I can get it going. And if we shoot it in New Brunswick, it'll mean all these jobs for the economy, because the economy in New Brunswick's like so bad now, and it would really help to create jobs and build the economy. So it's going to be really awesome once we start filming. What do you think, like, as a writer? Be honest. My sister's fine. It's Ottawa, for God's sakes. What kind of bad can happen in Ottawa?
Hubert, 54, Trois-Rivières, Quebec.
I seen you several times there in Perth, working the desk, that motel. You remember? I'm sure I saw you there a couple of weeks ago. What's happening down there? Something going on down there. Not sure what, but something. Up this way, it's more quiet. Not much going on. just the valley and the trees and the dark. Sometimes, now, at night, there are lights in the dark. Have you seen them? I've seen them twice now. Do you know what I'm talking about? When we stop here, at this place, I get the déjeuner, you know, the breakfast, hurly-bird. Even though we get here around 3 a.m., hurly-bird for sure, hurly-bird, that's me, that's all of us, getting the good breakfast before all the people who live here in this community wake up. The 3 a.m. hurly-bird special. Do you know how a girl, in her jeans, they make the ass look smaller? It's true. When a girl, she wears her jeans, she knows it makes her ass look smaller. Most times, I'm here alone, bus driver. Not everyone wants to talk to me. My English, she's not so good, mais je suis bilingue, hein? You understand me? Most people from New Brunswick sont anglophones, English. Ne veux vraiment pas parler avec moi. I'm just a bus driver, driving Miss Daisy. Because English people, they think the world belongs to them. But not in this place, see? Not in this dark province. Do you know how a fish in a cave? The cave, there's no light. And the fish, their skin begins to glow in the dark. In time, through the evolution, and their eyes, they turn white. They begin to see in the dark. Do you know how a deer, on the road, she crosses, and the lights of the bus, they catch? And the deer doesn't move. Looks into the lights as the bus drives right through its body. Do you know? I have a grandkid. And my grandkid, she asks, what's it like to drive a bus? And I tell her it's good. I make good money. I get to travel. I'm lying to her, though. My grandkid, I don't make good money. I don't get to travel. You might think, what do you mean? You're a bus driver? You're always on the road? And yes, that's true. But I'm always in the bus. I'm in the bus, and I get off at the stops to pick up the parcels and the mail and to eat the hurly-bird special. Sure, there are those little dots on the map. Whenever I get off, the scenery is like a movie. Always behind the screen. I do not travel. I'm always on the bus. In some ways, I travel less than people who never leave their neighborhood. It's just a job. It's just work. And the money, she's not good. Do you know how a deer on the road looks into the lights as the bus passes through? Do you know how a fish in a cave begins to see in the dark?
Omar, 28, Montreal, Quebec.
There are rumblings. Rumblings all over up here. It's not a good thing. You can tell by talking to the street kids. That's how you can tell. Normally, the last thing you want to talk to them. All sorts of crazy, and you have to watch your wallet. But me, I got my chain. It's all attached. And if I know if anyone tries to grab it, I can just use my Greco-Roman style wrestling, and that's it for them. So I don't feel fear talking to the punks. You get used to them, like landmarks, because they have their favorite spots and usually go to the same places at the same times, in the day and at night. And it becomes ritualistic for them, like their culture, so you can see them do that. And the cops. The cops can try and clear them out, but it's like trying to shoo away pigeons. With pigeons. Think about pigeons, sir. This isn't a forest. This is a city. This place is steel and concrete and flashing lights and people who don't give a fuck. And pigeons, sir, everywhere, all over, living, surviving in large herds, sir, for years, sir. They live here because they live around us, sir. That is their magic trick. They don't live with us. They live around us. That is evolution, sir. True working evolution. Finding a way around things, sir. Finding a way. They do not conquer. They do not fight. They live around us. Like the street kids, the ones who survive, they find a way. They live around, not with. They squeegee the cars, whether you ask them to or not. And if you tell them to fuck off, they barely even hear you, sir. Your voice barely even registers. They move on to the next car until the lights turn and they survive. The cops come and sit there, and if the cops go hard, they scatter, and the cops leave and they come back, just like the pigeons, sir, just like the birds. And just like the birds, you can tell if something is wrong with your city by looking at the street kids. If they stop congregating, if they dwindle in numbers, and they are dwindling, there are less of them about on the streets, and they are talking about it in the shelters, and the cops are talking about it too. You hear them talking about it on the street. You can see the look in their eyes. You can hear pieces of it on their radios. They are speaking softer to the street kids now. They do not shoo them away anymore, and they watch them now. Concern in their eyes. They ask them questions because they are curious, because they see it just like I see it. There is something wrong with the street kids, sir, because they are going missing, even though the pigeons are not. Something is happening. You look up at the cross on the mountain at night and wonder how it can shine so brightly. How can the cross be shining? How is it shining when something like this is happening? Speak with the street kids. They will tell you. They don't know what it is, but they will tell you. I will not go walking at night anymore in certain places, and I am a big man. And I know Greco-Roman style wrestling, but I will not go walking at night no more. But I am lucky, because the street kids, they have to walk. At night, they have to walk, and it is not good. Some of them refuse to go to the shelter, and that is not good. And they are going missing. Where are they going? There is nowhere they can go. There is nowhere for them to go, so they are going into the air. It's not good where they are going. I don't see how it can be good.
Lou, 59. Montreal, Quebec.
Some children, they do not remember. They have never had that experience. And this makes me sad. I never had that experience when I was a child. But I had it later in life, when it came to me. I did not follow this path when I was a child. I was very much a nerd or a geek, and I read beaucoup, beaucoup de livres. That was my thing. I liked the language. I liked the texts and books. And my father, he never showed an interest either, same as me. He was a teacher. He taught the maths à l'école. Plus de 40 ans. For more than 40 years. He was a teacher of maths. But when he got a cancer du poumon, because he smoked les cigarettes, and he was admitted to l'hôpital, after this, he became interested in the game. He became interested in baseball. This was in 82, when he was sick. We put a radio dans son chambre à l'hôpital. Il toujours listened to les jeux des expos. This was something he had ever done before, his whole life, which I had ever witnessed. Yeah, I was 24 years of age in 82. And every once in a while, We got to take him, my father, to the Stadium Olympique to watch les expos. And when we would get there in the stadium and in our seats, we would watch the game. And my father, he would watch with both eyes wide, like a child's. Like he was seeing something for the first time, this baseball. And you know how they say that the closer you get to death, the more you become like a child? I believe this is what was happening to my father. I believe he was becoming like a child. Because a child looks at the world like it is magic. Like they are full with wonder. This is what my father was like. And this was in 82. Like they were waking up after a bunch of disappointing saisons. But even though they were doing better, they did not win every game. People were used to this in Montreal. People would hope for the best, but expected to lose. And if les Expos lost the game, it was not la fin du monde, because there was always tomorrow. There would always be another game tomorrow. And this is how people thought. But my father, whenever we took him to a game and the Expos, they would start to be losing, he would start talking to himself out loud, talking to himself, but we could hear him. Oui, la Grande Orange. He would say to no one. Oui, la Grande Orange. I did not know what he was trying to say. I did not know, and when I asked him, he would just look at me like I was the crazy one. So I had to end up asking my friend, who was a fan of baseball, this question. Qui est le Grand Orange? And my friend, he smiled at me and said, Rusty Staub. Rusty Staub had been a player for les Expos years earlier. A man with red hair and the first superstar of les Expos. He was a hero from the past. And my father must have remembered him. And that is why he was saying that whenever les Expos began to lose. If you look at it, the stadium, it looks very odd. It looks like the corpse of some animal that has begun to rot after it dies. The tower looks like when the flesh gets eaten away clean and a white bone sticks up through the corpse. The designer of the stadium, he designed it to look like the vertebrae of an animal. And this is how I think of it now. They built it dans le parc. Vraiment, it looks like the bones of an animal you would come across if you were hunting. The corpse of an animal in a field. I would think of this whenever we would go to watch the games with les Expos. How you know how sometimes a young child will find the dead body of an animal for the first time in their lives and play with it? Because they don't know what it is. It is just an object to them. Or how a child would play in the graveyard and step on the graves because they do not know. We would go to the games to watch les Expos, and my father looking like a child and feeling like we were all gathered together in his big skeleton, you know? Playing games like children inside the skeleton of some dead animal gigantic. I think this is how the designer wanted it. Because how in life the flowers and plants will grow up around a dead body, and life will flourish there, and insects will live in the corpse, and the plants will grow up through the body, you know? I think that is what the designer was thinking. My father died quickly. He did not make it à la saison prochaine. But I kept going to the games from then on. For him. It was for him. Because I think that at the end of his life, he had regrets, you know? That he had grown up too fast. He missed out on something, you know, in his childhood. And there are many people who complain about his expo, Il Stadium, because it cost the people here so much money, you know? $1.5 billion. It is a lot. A lot to pay for a pile of bones. Des os blancs d'un animal gigantique. When they left les expos, they left the stadium behind. Too big to take with them, you know? I still go out to les os blancs now. Every couple of weeks to see the place with my eyes again, you know? I take the metro to P9 on the Green Line to see with my own eyes the graveyard that used to house this expo and all of the life at that time. And it feels like the place is waiting, you know? It doesn't feel like it is finished. It feels like it is waiting. Like a promise. Où est le grand orange?
Nikki, 27, Montreal, Quebec.
We think it's got to be like some kind of cult, like some kind of Freemason type thing that's been organizing itself secretly for years. That's the only explanation we can come up with. Because whoever it is that's behind it, they've got their fingers into everything. Especially the media. Not just the news, but the social media. And, I mean, you see some people posting about the strangeness going on. A little here and there, and the odd guy ranting about it. But those posts, have you noticed? They're not staying up for very long. That's why there's no panic yet, or, you know, that kind of thing. Someone's working things from behind the scenes that has their fingers everywhere. And they're trying to keep whatever's going on or whatever they themselves are up to with the bodies and the kidnappings. They're trying to keep it all hush-hush. They might even be listening to us now. I know that's a real cliche line to say, but I think it might actually be true in this case. Some groups of people are powerful enough that they actually might be listening to us right now in this hostel. Through the use of satellites or whatever, the technology exists. We know that already. So if these people, cult, whatever they are, Freemasons, are in positions of power, then why couldn't they be using this technology to keep whatever plot or operation right now under wraps and listening for people who might be talking about it to get rid of them preemptively, you know? You should walk real careful and keep your nose down. If they, whoever they are, know you're walking around with a tape recorder, who knows? They might target you, think you're up to something that might ruin, get in the way of whatever the fuck their plans are. What do you think their plans are? My boyfriend said he would text me a half an hour ago. He still hasn't texted me. He's in Manitoba. Why hasn't he texted me? What's going on in Manitoba right now? It's been a half an hour, and I don't think I'm overreacting here. I came here from Labrador, and you got to drive through the wilderness to get to here from Labrador. And let me tell you, something ain't right. The people in Labrador were fucking spooked. They were not their friendly, newfie selves this time around when I went there to make the drop. Heroin. To my buddy's friend. For my buddy. Not my boyfriend. He's a surveyor. He doesn't know my on-the-side stuff I do for my buddy. Because you can't abandon your friends, you know, when they need you. My car still works, right? Doesn't matter if you're in a relationship or not. And my buddy paid me in coke, so especially considering how much coke it was, I couldn't turn it down. You try being in a relationship with a guy who takes off for 6 weeks at a time to go surveying in Manitoba. What the hell is there to survey in Manitoba, even? That's another good question. Here's another tip. Never do coke in your own apartment. Learned that a long time ago. If you get any coke, go to a hostel. If your boyfriend's in Manitoba, he'll never find out. Because you never meet anybody you know in a hostel, you know? You could be next. That's what I'm getting at. That's my ultimate point. And if we post about something on Facebook, someone's going to unpost it. You get me? Like maybe the Freemasons. Try it. Try posting it on Facebook. I'm not. Fuck that. I deleted my account. And I don't talk to anyone I don't know anymore. I never talk to people at hostels. Except you. Except you. Because you gotta talk to somebody or else you become a crazy person. What was your name again?
Dwight. 37. Montreal, Quebec.
I had asked her if she could cook us up some meatballs. Sweet and sour meatballs. Because I've always liked meatballs, and she was a real good cook. And her meatballs were awesome. And we hadn't had them in a while, because money has been tight for the last little while, and I got this pay raise recently. And so, it was just after I had got the pay raise, like a couple days after that, and we were ahead of our bills, and I wasn't feeling too stressed out about anything. And I think she could sense that. And she was kind of more relaxed than usual as well. Probably because I was more relaxed. And she was able to relax more. So, we were a little more relaxed than we had been this year. And we were actually enjoying each other's company. And having fun around each other again. So, I asked her if she'd cook some meatballs that night. We'd first met about 6 years ago. Both of us old enough to know that we were sick of the bar scene. And really didn't want to expose ourselves to the dating pool anymore. I think maybe that helped us get going and stick together through all of that early phase turbulence a lot of couples can't seem to make it through. But after a while, we really started to kind of unexpectedly love each other. Like, I'm not sure what our designs were when we first started up, what designs we had originally placed upon each other. We fell in love at some point there, and after we kind of found ourselves a way into it, and so, yeah, we were very happy. A bit stressed because of bills, but happy. There's kind of a happy, stressed out kind of way you can carry on, like, once you get the hang of it. This happy sort of stressed out kind of everything sucks, but what are you gonna do type of way of living. And when a little breather happens, when a little bit of stress goes away due to one person getting a raise or one person having something good finally happen to them that day, it's really welcome. First off, these little breaks from the stress, but it also gives you a chance to remember all the love and stuff you're feeling for each other. And that's what was happening to me and Allison. Because the raise I got gave us just enough to clear a little bit more of our bills a bit. Like, we had been holding our breath for ages and finally had a chance to just breathe a little bit again. Her cooking was amazing, so I wanted her meatballs. And she actually wanted to make them for me that night, so she did. And I don't know what she put in them. Like, onions and peppers, obviously. Like, the ingredients I could see, obviously I knew those were there. But there was more going into her meatballs than just onions and peppers. Because you could tell when she cooked them, first off. And second, when you put them in your mouth and began to chew and all of the flavor. She had some kind of secret ingredient. And whenever I asked her what the secret ingredient was, she'd always just say, love. And that was funny to her and to me because we'd always been real sarcastic people, and that was just about the lamest thing either of us had ever heard. Whenever one of those morons on the Food Network would say that they were cooking with love, literally the dumbest thing we'd ever heard. She'd say, love. And I would tell her to shut up, and she'd laugh about it, and it would make me smile when she laughed. Because I knew how stupid we both thought that was of a thing to say. When you're asking about food. Because food is just work, right? It's all preparation and focus and timing and attention to detail and heat. Having the proper ingredients and tools to get the job done in the first place. In reality. The meatballs that night were pretty good. They weren't her best. The glaze wasn't as sweet as she normally made it. Whatever. they were still pretty good. We went to bed that night, and I couldn't sleep. So I read from my science fiction book, because I like science fiction, while Allison eventually got in bed and fell asleep right beside me. Children of Dune by Frank Herbert. And I finished the book that night. But it wasn't my first time reading the book before. I'd read it already like 6 times before then. This was my 7th time finishing it. I let the book fall off the bed, because it was a soft cover. I reached down to scratch my knee, because it was itchy. Then I brought my hand up again to turn the knob on the lamp on the nightstand beside the bed. Turned off the light. Listened to Allison breathing beside me in the dark. Listened to Allison breathing beside me in the dark. She's beside me. Breathing. We're in the dark together. And she's breathing. Breathing in and out and breathing. I can hear her breathing. Hear it now. In my mind, just hear her breathing. I woke up in the morning, and she wasn't breathing anymore. And her body was cold. And because of all the stories I'd been hearing about people going missing and such, I couldn't leave the room to go get my phone because I'd left it downstairs beside hers on the kitchen table the night before when I'd gone to bed, because I was an idiot. I didn't want to leave her side and have her go missing. How corny is that, right? Me, this intelligent guy, and knowing all these stories we're hearing about people disappearing, knowing it's all bullshit, tacky, superstitious, but still, being afraid because I didn't want. I was afraid if I left the room, her body, her corpse, to get my phone, to call the hospital that she might not be. Her body might not be there. If I left and came back. Because I love her. I do love her. So I couldn't not go and get my phone. Not for some stupid reason like that, because of superstitions or fear or foolishness. I had to call someone. The hospital, you know? I went downstairs to get my phone from the table, and then I went back upstairs. We were laughing the night before about putting love into the meatballs. Because that's not what really happens. That's not a real thing. Her body was gone. I came back. Her body was gone.
Fortune of Wolves was written by Ryan Griffith. The series was produced by Big Noise Audio Collective and presented by Theatre New Brunswick. The show was directed by Ryan Griffith with help from Gillian Hansen. Recording, editing, and sound design by Matt Carter. Music for the series was created by Counting On Downstairs, with additional scoring by Matt Carter. To learn more about the series and the artists involved, visit tnb.nb.ca or look for the Big Noise Audio Collective on Facebook. This episode featured Kat Hall as the Chief Archivist, Jason McIntyre as Lowell, Brianna Parker Tarasco as Wanda, Pierre Huard as Hubert, Gary Weeks as Omar, Greg Shanks as Dwight, Jason Roy as Lou, and Maggie Esty as Nikki. Next time on Fortune of Wolves.
Montreal is huge.
What the Fermi Paradox is saying is that even if the odds are completely stacked against life in the universe, there should still remain at least 100 habitable planets with intelligent life like ours for every single grain of sand on planet Earth.
So, yeah. Yeah, I'm happy.
This time of night, the streets outside used to be way busier.
I'll get her food, because that's what a wolf would do if she was part of his pack.